Chapter 2. Orient, but always gave up the idea, partly because of the great length of the journey and partly because my wife could not well manage to go with me. Towards the end of last January, that idea, after an interval of years, came suddenly into my head again, forcefully too, and without any apparent reason. Whence came it? What suggested it? I will touch upon that presently. I was at that time, where I am now, in Paris. I wrote at once to Henry M. Stanley, London, and asked him some questions about his Australian lecture tour, and inquired who had conducted him, and what were the terms. After a day or two his answer came. It began. He lecture agent for Australia and New Zealand is par excellence Mr. R. S. Smythe, of Melbourne. He added his itinerary, terms, see expenses, and some other matters, and advised me to write Mr. Smythe, which I did. February 3d I began my letter, by saying in substance that, while he did not know me personally, we had a mutual friend in Stanley, and that would answer for an introduction. Then I proposed my trip, and asked if he would give me the same terms which he had given Stanley. I mailed my letter to Mr. Smythe February 6th, and 3 days later I got a letter from the selfsame Smythe, dated Melbourne, December 17th. I would as soon have expected to get a letter from the late George Washington. The letter began somewhat as mine to him had begun, with a self-introduction. Dear Mr. Clemens, it is so long since Archibald Forbes and I spent that pleasant afternoon in your comfortable house at Hartford, that you have probably quite forgotten the occasion. In the course of his letter this occurs. I'm willing to give you here be named the terms which he had given Stanley, or an Antipodean tour to last, say, 3 months. Here was the single essential detail of my letter answered 3 days after I had mailed my inquiry. I might have saved myself the trouble and the postage, and a few years ago I would have done that very thing, for I would have argued that my sudden and strong impulse to write and ask some questions of a stranger on the underside of the globe meant that the impulse came from that stranger, and that he would answer my questions of his own motion, if I would let him alone. Mr. Smythe's letter probably passed under my nose on its way, to lose 3 weeks traveling to America and back, and gave me a whiff of its contents as it went along. Letters often act like that. Instead of the thought coming to you in an instant from Australia, the apparently unsentient letter imparts it to you as it glides invisibly past your elbow in the mail bag. Next incident. In the following month, March, I was in America. I spent a Sunday at Irvington on the Hudson with Mr. John Brisbane Walker, of the Cosmopolitan magazine. We came into New York next morning, and went to the Century Club for luncheon. He said some praiseful things about the character of the club, and the orderly serenity and pleasantness of its quarters, and asked if I had never tried to acquire membership in it. I said I had not, and that New York clubs were a continuous expense to the country members without being of frequent use or benefit to them. And now I've got an idea, said one. Here's the Lotos, the first New York club I was ever a member of, my very earliest love in that line. I have been a member of it for considerably more than 20 years, yet have seldom had a chance to look in and see the boys. They turn gray and grow old while I am not watching. And my dues go on. I am going to Hartford this afternoon for a day or two, but as soon as I get back I will go to John Elderkin very privately and say, remember the veteran and confer distinction upon him, for the sake of old times. Make me an honorary member and abolish the tax. If you haven't any such thing as honorary membership, all the better, create it for my honor and glory. That would be a great thing. I will go to John Elderkin as soon as I get back from Hartford. I took the last express that afternoon, first telegraphing Mr. F.G. Whitmore to come and see me next day. When he came he asked, Colin, did you get a letter from Mr. John Elderkin, secretary of the Lotos Club, before you left New York? Then it just missed you. If I had known you were coming, I would have kept it. It is beautiful, and will make you proud. The board of directors, by unanimous vote, have made you a life member, and squelched those dues, and you are to be on hand, and receive your distinction on the night of the 30th, which is the 25th anniversary of the founding of the club, and it will not surprise me if they have some great times there. What put the honorary membership in my head, that day in the Century Club, for I had never thought of it before. I don't know what brought the thought to me at that particular time instead of earlier, but I am well satisfied that it originated with the board of directors, and had been on its way to my brain through the air ever since the moment that saw their vote recorded. Another incident. I was in Hartford 2 or 3 days as a guest of the Rev. Joseph H. Twitchell. I have held the rank of honorary uncle to his children for a quarter of a century, and I went out with him in the trolley car to visit one of my nieces, who is at Miss Porter's famous school in Farmington. The distance is 8 or 9 miles. On the way, talking, I illustrated something with an anecdote. This is the anecdote. 2 years and a half ago I and the family arrived at Milan on our way to Rome, and stopped at the Continental. After dinner I went below, and took a seat in the stone-paved court, where the customary lemon trees stand in the customary tubs, and said to myself, now this is comfort, comfort and repose, and nobody to disturb it. I do not know anybody in Milan. Then a young gentleman stepped up and shook hands, which damaged my theory. He said, in substance, you won't remember me, Mr. Clemens, but I remember you very well. I was a cadet at West Point when you and Rev. Joseph H. Twitchell came there some years ago, and talked to us on a 100th night. I am a lieutenant in the regular army now, and my name is H. I am in Europe, all alone, for a modest little tour. My regiment is in Arizona. We became friendly and sociable, and in the course of the talk he told me of an adventure which had befallen him about to this effect. I was at Bellagio, stopping at the big hotel there, and 10 days ago I lost my letter of credit. I did not know what in the world to do. I was a stranger. I knew no one in Europe. I hadn't a penny in my pocket. I couldn't even send a telegram to London to get my lost letter replaced. My hotel bill was a week old, and the presentation of it imminent, so imminent, that it could happen at any moment now. I was so frightened, that my wits seemed to leave me. I tramped and tramped, back and forth, like a crazy person. If anybody approached me I hurried away, for no matter what a person looked like, I took him for the head waiter with the bill. I was at last in such a desperate state that I was ready to do any wild thing that promised even the shadow of help, and so this is the insane thing that I did. I saw a family lunching at a small table on the veranda, and recognized their nationality: Americans, father, mother, and several young daughters, young, tastefully dressed, and pretty to rule with our people. I went straight there in my civilian costume, named my name, said I was a lieutenant in the army, and told my story and asked for help. What do you suppose the gentleman did? But you would not guess in 20 years. He took out a handful of gold coin, and told me to help myself freely. That is what he did. The next morning the lieutenant told me his new letter of credit had arrived in the night, so we strolled to Cook's to draw money to pay back the benefactor with. We got it, and then went strolling through the great arcade. Presently he said, yonder they are, come and be introduced. I was introduced to the parents and the young ladies, then we separated, and I never saw him or them again. Here we are at Farmington, said Twitchell, interrupting. We left the trolley car and tramped through the mud 100 yards or so to the school, talking about the time we and Warner walked out there years ago, and the pleasant time we had. We had a visit with my niece in the parlor, then started for the trolley again. Outside the house we encountered a double rank of 20 or 30 of Miss Porter's young ladies arriving from a walk, and we stood aside, ostensibly to let them have room to file past, but really to look at them. Presently one of them stepped out of the rank and said, "You don't know me, Mr. Twitchell, but I know your daughter, and that gives me the privilege of shaking hands with you." Then she put out her hand to me, and said, "And I wish to shake hands with you too, Mr. Clemens. You don't remember me, but you were introduced to me in the arcade in Milan 2 years and a half ago by Lieutenant H. What had put that story into my head after all that stretch of time? Was it just the proximity of that young girl, or was it merely an odd accident? The invalid story, I seem 60 and married, but these effects are due to my condition and sufferings, for I am a bachelor, and only 41. It will be hard for you to believe that I, who am now but a shadow, was a hale, hearty man 2 short years ago, a man of iron, a very athlete. Yet such is the simple truth. But stranger still than this fact is the way in which I lost my health. I lost it through helping to take care of a box of guns on a 200-mile railway journey one winter's night. It is the actual truth, and I will tell you about it. I belong in Cleveland, Ohio. One winter's night, 2 years ago, I reached home just after dark, in a driving snowstorm, and the first thing I heard when I entered the house was that my dearest boyhood friend and schoolmate, John B. Hackett, had died the day before, and that his last utterance had been a desire that I would take his remains home to his poor old father and mother in Wisconsin. I was greatly shocked and grieved, but there was no time to waste in emotions. I must start at once. I took the card, marked Eakin Levi Hackett, Bethlehem, Wisconsin, and hurried off through the whistling storm to the railway station. Arrived there, I found the long white pine box which had been described to me. I fastened the card to it with some tacks, saw it put safely aboard the express car, and then ran into the eating room to provide myself with a sandwich and some cigars. When I returned, presently, there was my coffin box back again, apparently, and a young fellow examining around it, with a card in his hands, and some tacks and a hammer. I was astonished and puzzled. He began to nail on his card, and I rushed out to the express car, in a good deal of a state of mind, to ask for an explanation. But no, there was my box, all right, in the express car. It hadn't been disturbed. The fact is that without my suspecting it, a prodigious mistake had been made. I was carrying off a box of guns which that young fellow had come to the station to ship to a rifle company in Peoria, Illinois, and he had got my corpse. Just then the conductor sung out "LL aboard," and I jumped into the express car and got a comfortable seat on a bale of buckets. The expressman was there, hard at work, a plain man of 50, with a simple, honest, good-natured face, and a breezy, practical heartiness in his general style. As the train moved off, a stranger skipped into the car and set a package of peculiarly mature and capable Limburger cheese on one end of my coffin box, I mean my box of guns. That is to say, I know now that it was Limburger cheese, but at that time I never had heard of the article in my life, and of course was wholly ignorant of its character. Well, we sped through the wild night, the bitter storm raged on, a cheerless misery stole over me, my heart went down, down, down. The old expressman made a brisk remark or two about the tempest and the Arctic weather, slammed his sliding doors to, and bolted them, closed his window down tight, and then went bustling around, here and there and yonder, setting things to rights, and all the time contentedly humming "Wheat by and by," in a low tone, and flatting a good deal. Presently I began to detect a most evil and searching odor stealing about on the frozen air. This depressed my spirits still more, because of course I attributed it to my poor departed friend. There was something infinitely saddening about his calling himself to my remembrance in this dumb, pathetic way, so it was hard to keep the tears back. Moreover, it distressed me on account of the old expressman, who, I was afraid, might notice it. However, he went humming tranquilly on, and gave no sign, and for this I was grateful. Grateful, yes, but still uneasy, and soon I began to feel more and more uneasy every minute, for every minute that went by that odor thickened up the more, and got to be more and more gamey and hard to stand. Presently, having got things arranged to his satisfaction, the expressman got some wood and made up a tremendous fire in his stove. This distressed me more than I can tell, for I could not but feel that it was a mistake. I was sure that the effect would be deleterious upon my poor departed friend. Thompson, the expressman's name was Thompson, as I found out in the course of the night, now went poking around his car, stopping up whatever stray cracks he could find, remarking that it didn't make any difference what kind of a night it was outside, he calculated to make us comfortable, anyway. I said nothing, but I believed he was not choosing the right way. Meantime he was humming to himself just as before. And meantime, too, the stove was getting hotter and hotter, and the place closer and closer. I felt myself growing pale and qualmish, but grieved in silence and said nothing. Soon I noticed that the wheat by and by was gradually fading out. Next it ceased altogether, and there was an ominous stillness. After a few moments Thompson said, "Phew! I reckon it ain't no cinnamon tea I've loaded up this year stove with." He gasped once or twice, then moved toward the cough gun box, stood over that Limburger cheese part of a moment, then came back and sat down near me, looking a good deal impressed. After a contemplative pause, he said, indicating the box with a gesture, "Friend of yourn?" "Yes," I said with a sigh. "He's pretty ripe, ain't he?" Nothing further was said for perhaps a couple of minutes, each being busy with his own thoughts. Then Thompson said, in a low, odd voice, "Sometimes it's uncertain whether they're really gone or not, seem gone, you know, body warm, joints limber, and so, although you think they're gone, you don't really know. I've had cases in my car. It's perfectly awful, because you don't know what minute they'll rise up and look at you." Then, after a pause, and slightly lifting his elbow toward the box, "But he ain't in no trance. No, sir, I go bail for him." We sat some time, in meditative silence, listening to the wind and the roar of the train. Then Thompson said, with a good deal of feeling, "Well, well, we've all got to go, they ain't no getting around it. Man that is born of woman is of few days and far between, as scripture says. Yes, you look at it any way you want to, it's awful solemn and curious. They ain't nobody can get around it. All's got to go, just everybody, as you may say. One day you're hearty and strong." Here he scrambled to his feet, and broke a pane, and stretched his nose out at it a moment or two, then sat down again, while I struggled up and thrust my nose out at the same place, and this we kept on doing every now and then, and next day he's cut down like the grass, and the places which knowed him then knows him no more forever, as scripture says. Yesn't it, it's awful solemn and curious. But we've all got to go, one time or another, they ain't no getting around it." There was another long pause, then, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.